Moncrief on News Talk.
You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Our WhatsApp number 087 1400 106. Joanna Fortune's with us once again for our parenting slot. Afternoon, Joanna.
Afternoon, Sean.
Right, here's your first question. I'm writing this on day 6 of crying into my cereal, so I'm hoping you can give me some perspective. We recently received a phone call from our creche to advise that it's closing. We are lucky to have secured a place somewhere else, but the place we have secured is a little bit out of the way, and there are unlikely to be other children there from the old creche. I'm struggling hugely with the thoughts of my daughter trying to settle in somewhere so new where she knows no one. She's 3.5, has been attending the old creche since she was 1. How can I prepare her for this move? How can I help her once the move is done? How can I stop myself from feeling so guilty about the whole thing? She's incredibly attached to me and really thrives in the routine we're currently in. People have told me all week that children are resilient and this is likely to be more stressful for the adult than the child. Interested to understand if that's accurate.
Oh, like the stress is palpable from this letter. Children are resilient like any of us when they are resourced to cope.
Yes.
Okay, just that this kind of mantra people casually toss around is really to reassure each other. Sure, children are resilient. They'll bounce back. Don't worry. If we want to raise resilient children, we resource them. Okay. And so their resources to cope outweigh the stress they're coping with. Ergo, like any of us, they're resilient. So hold that in mind and focus as much as you can at the moment and being very realistic that your child is in childcare because you work likely or have other things going on. But during the transitional phase, if you can be as available as you can be, even if it's a little bit later in the morning to make sure you're there for drop off and to pick her up or whatever way you work it, for the week before and the first week of that transition, I think that could be really helpful for her that she's seeing you. You know, each time, and you're there if there is any wobbles, if she's not settling, anything like that, that you are close by and available. I think as well, and this is probably more of a reach at the moment, speak very positively about this move, about this new place. Try to get a visit to the new place if you haven't already yourself. Because I really think you have to go yourself first and get a sense of the place before you go with her, and then go with her for a visit so she can see where she's going. If that's not an option, at the very least, you go and then take a photo of the outside of it so she can visualize where she's going. I'd nearly, you know, practice the journey because you're saying it's a little bit out of the way. Practice the new drive, you know, maybe design a little playlist on your, you know, music, whatever you use, in the car so that you can have the same sing song on the way that's cueing her. It's new, it's different, it's fresh, but it's we sing our way to the door to go there. Little things like that are how you prepare her. I would ensure as well that she gets a goodbye with her current care team. It's not just they disappear and she's like, well, where did they go? But that there is, because she's 3.5.
So
she's going to have questions about that. I just think, though, when that's the kind of practical stuff of what can you do to help prepare a child. But as you're reading this, day 6 of crying for the grown up, struggling hugely, feeling so guilty, stressful. The words used in this are about... And you know, Sean, I get it, because leaving our children in a childcare setting is an exercise in trust. And this parent has clearly had and enjoyed that trust-based relationship with her current childcare setting for such a long time, and how lucky and beautiful that is that you've had it. So it's really understandable as a parent to feel anxious about going to creche, but be really aware that your daughter is going to look to you to take her emotional behavioral cues about this new place. I don't say that to make you feel guilty or, you know, to put some manic grin on your face and pretend, but I think you've got to, you need your goodbye with the care team. You need to thank them for all of the trust that you've had in them, for taking such good care of your baby with you, for you, and for helping you to manage that. And I think trust that where you're bringing your daughter has, you know, equally highly skilled, caring staff.
Yeah, no doubt.
And she's 3.5 going in here, which is different than leaving a 1-year-old. She can tell you if she's not happy or what she's not happy with. A lot of her day is going to be, I imagine, consumed with preschool curriculum while she's in there. She's older, and you can present this to her as, we're going to a new school to get ready for big school. We're going to this new place and present there. But I think whatever way, when you drop her off the first few days, make sure you've made a plan to meet somebody for a cup of coffee yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't be on your own. Don't be sitting outside in the car crying. Go meet somebody for a coffee. Go for a walk, get some movement, and just mind yourself through the transition.
She did well, actually, getting a place.
Hugely. And I know she acknowledges this, but, you know, look, we are lucky, but it's not what she wants.
Yeah, of course.
What she wants is her trusted, safe, predictable, reliable place. And that's really hard to let go of.
Yeah. It says something, though, about the perilous state of childcare
that absolutely
a crush like that can, not out of the blue, obviously they've given them some notice,
but they're closing.
They're closing.
Yeah, they and they've made that decision because of how the demands, and look, there's so many complexities involved in that. But childcare is such a stressful, tenuous thing for parents. And I think it's why the trust is so key in this.
Yeah.
But this is about taking that risk on. Look, you found somewhere new, you've clearly done your research on it, you're happy with it, and you will get happy with it the more you build a relationship with them. So focus on building a relationship.
Yeah. I'm a mother of a happy, clever and witty almost 9-year-old girl. I sometimes wonder if I should have her assessed for autism traits or what is to be gained by being assessed. In general, she's a happy child. She does very well academically and her teacher said that she has friends and gets on well with everyone. The teacher notes that my daughter avoids the drama that sometimes happens. She also gets on well with her little sister, 6.5, dotes on her little brother, 2.5. I've observed her with her friends. When in the same setting as them, she won't engage with them immediately. She might stand behind them for a while until they engage with her. In settings where she doesn't know the kids, she doesn't engage but stands on the edges. I have observed that she communicates easier with adults. When she's feeling anxious, I notice she can sometimes start flicking her fingers. She's recently started clapping her hands when she gets excited. She also enjoys other activities that involve a lot of movement, like walking on the top of the couch or jumping from bed to bed. Yes, laughs of recognition to that one, I can definitely tell you. When she has, how many pictures have I put back on the wall? I don't know how that fell down. Anyway, when she has a meltdown, it is as if she cannot control her emotions. They completely overtake her. She often retreats to her room to calm down, or she will scream and rage in a way that sometimes seems in excess of what has occurred. I do not want her labelled if it is going to negatively change her own self-image or other people's perception of her. I'm conscious, however, that puberty and periods are around the corner, and I feel it might be good to have some extra support in place for all the changes that brings.
Oh, okay.
Right, there's a lot there.
There's a lot there. And I mean, look, it sounds like you have a lovely, kind little girl who sometimes struggles a lot with emotional regulation in particular.
Yeah.
And she can have big emotional responses that seem disproportionate to the situation. Okay, like that's a fair summation, I think, here. And I think, look, it's, I'm not going to sit here and say, based on what's here, you do or don't go for assessment, because this is a snapshot that we're getting.
Yeah.
And something tells me that if you've taken the time to write in with this question, you have more details. Like, you have a pattern here. You're outlining a few things that are standing out to you. I imagine you've probably Googled, please don't Google things like this. You know, it can be quite terrifying. But the decision to consult with a psychologist is yours to make. Mm. Now, I tend to think, Sean, if you have grounds to question something, it is worth getting that question answered, because you will sit with that question and it will come back to you.
Yes.
And then when you're daughter is 14 or 15, you'll go, oh, we should have done something about that question. You know, so if you've a question, there's a reason you have it, go and see somebody. You are not going to get an assessment for no reason. If you have an initial consultation with a psychologist and you outline in more detail than what you've done here, but give more examples, they are going to say, okay, based on what you've said, I would like to see your child, or I don't think there's any reason to proceed with this.
Yeah.
So you can always do that. An assessment, when you're saying, you know, you don't want her labelled if it's going to negatively change, an assessment, we have to challenge this idea that when we have our children assessed for something, it is really to better understand how they're negotiating the world, how they're experiencing the world, how their brain, how their nervous system, how they work. And it's there so that, you know, just as much as it is to understand them and help them and make sure they have the supports they need, it's also so that we can tailor our parenting of them so that we're parenting the child in front of us rather than saying, will you stop doing that thing that now I know you really can't stop doing?
Yeah.
You know, that I'm not critiquing behaviours that actually are part of how you're trying to self-regulate. I'm thinking of what's maybe behind the idea that she's clapping or clicking or wiggling her fingers, that there's something in that about trying to self-regulate. So instead of saying, don't clap, go, okay, let's get outside and run around for a while, looking at other ways that you can do that. So don't think of it as labeling her. Think of it as exploring who and how she is so you can better understand her and parent her in a way that is in the is in her best needs. That's really what this is about. And I think it really helps to create a shared understanding that when we can talk with our children about if there was a diagnosis or anybody listening who has a child who's been diagnosed with some kind of, I don't know, whatever it might be, developmental consideration, that we talk to our children about their diagnosis so that they have that shared understanding of, oh, that's why things get a bit hard for me, or that's why my feelings get really big and out of control. And we can actually, you know, destigmatize it by keeping it an open conversation. I think that's really important, because when you were saying here and you were reading through all of this, I was like, okay, okay. And then you said when she has a meltdown, it's as if she cannot control her emotions. Now, a meltdown is different to a tantrum.
Yeah,
tantrums are parentally challenging, but developmentally typical behaviours in young children. They're generally quite like a performance. They need an audience. You have displeased me. I will now perform my displeasure for you. A meltdown is different. A meltdown is when I'm sensory, so overwrought, overstimulated that I cannot regulate or be co-regulated, ergo I melt down.
Yeah.
And there could be nobody with me, or there could be 500 people around me, and I have no control over that situation. So I was curious about, well, how often are these meltdowns happening and what are the triggers? So that alone, I think, is worth having a conversation with a mental health professional, psychologist in this instance, because you're thinking or exploring, should you have an assessment? And I think in that you may even get some helpful strategies for supporting her through those moments, even if you're not progressing beyond that point.
Yeah.
So I still think it is worth it. Bear in mind that if you were going down the public route, getting referred, first of all, is going to be part of the challenge. Then there's the very long wait list, but also be aware the private services also have significant wait lists at the moment. Generally speaking, I don't know where you are in the country, but I actually think it is countrywide. So it's worth getting on a list or a couple of lists now, because you could be waiting 5-6 months privately and certainly a lot more publicly.
From my completely unqualified position, I can't quite. Is there something here, or is this kind of perfectly normal 9-year-old stuff, really? Because it could be either.
I mean, it really could. And I think that's the question.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you've got a situation here where you're going, oh, red flag, go get that looked at. I think you've got a pattern. It's like a breadcrumb trail through this letter. You know, there's little nuggets where you're like, okay, that's a question. That's a question. Generally speaking, you've a happy, healthy little girl who's doing mostly well most of the time. But I think as a parent, when you have that wondering or that question, it is worth talking to somebody who can help you think through what's behind that. Where are you getting your question from? How long have you been carrying it? So that's why I think even in an initial conversation with a psychologist as a parent could be very helpful here.
Yeah. Though, as you say, that might take a while. Okay. Right. Next question is this. Our soon to be 5-year-old has a really good relationship with both of us, mum and dad. And we do have quite a good balance in terms of tasks in the home. For example, breakfast, dressing, dinner, bath, drop off and collection, playing, etc. But when there is a perceived choice, the preference is always for mum. The only area where there seems to be a challenge for us is about bedtime. And in particular, if and when she arrives into our room during the night. About a year ago, we introduced every second night bedtimes, as it had become a fully mum job, with dad doing bedtime only if mum was not around. We didn't think this was reflecting the balance that we wanted and caused lots of crying and distress when it wasn't mum taking her to bed. The alternate nights is working well, and while there is still a little resistance heading to bed, it's usually as straightforward a process as you can expect. The real tension arises during the night if she comes into our room having been woken up. She never comes into our bed. And she never comes into our bed. She requests and we encourage that she is brought back to her own bed to fall asleep. The thing is that the strong preference is that it's always mum who does the nighttime bit. Some key things to say is that when mum is not there, She settles quickly and falls asleep. But each night, when, if mum doesn't take her back to bed, there is a bedtime routine where one of us explains dad will do it tonight and to give mum a hug or a kiss, etc. But she gets more and more distressed to the point of shouting and crying and sometimes lashing out. We try to stay calm during this time and signpost what will happen and remind her that it's okay. But we don't know how to change the narrative or how we can help ourselves and her move past this routine, which clearly causes her distress. Given the arrival of the baby, we would love to make dad taking her back to bed more acceptable for her. Any advice you can provide would be gratefully received.
OK, there's a couple of things in this. So first of all, it's quite common. Very common, let me clarify, for a child to show preference for one parent to do things over another. That in no way says, I don't love the other parent. It is simply stating a preference.
I might
like the way you do it. I might particularly want that time with you at nighttime, whatever it is. But this kind of soon to be five. So this is also an age of increased independence or seeking independence. And that also includes asserting choice and preference. That is a part of independence. So I hear your invitation for dad to do it, but I want you to do it. And now I'm going to push the boundary, test the limit, and I'm going to try and get what I want so it's happening on my terms. That's all very normal.
Yeah. Like,
and we're not going to psychopathologize that. That's really normal. This little bit at the end, given the arrival of the baby, I was like, oh, hang on. Okay.
Ding dong, yeah.
I mean, I'm going, well, do you know what? You're likely to see much more mom demands now that there's a baby because you're less available. So the less available you are, the more I'm going to want you. So whether the baby has arrived or that's a pending arrival, your five-year-old is very clued into that. I'd also say, though, apart from this, these parents have a highly structured bedtime routine.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, great, fair play to you if it's working and it's been going on for a long time, but it is highly structured and it works mostly well most of the time for you all. But, and I'm going to say, be careful of how high your expectations are of a not yet five-year-old child.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, there's an awful lot of the middle of the night when she's stumbling in half sleepy, I want mommy to do it. And you're saying, well, now let's be reasonable and let's explain and let's structure. And there's just too much cognitive work going on there. There's too many words. There's too much verbal direction. And we have a system. Let's stick to the system. There's too much of that for a five-year-old child. You know, you're asking that she hold steady while everything around her is changing with a new baby.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a fair expectation of a child, any child, but a child this age. I also think, you know, dad'll do it tonight, give mom a hug or all of this stuff, you know, fine, but she's five and sleepy in the middle of the night. I'm wondering if dad could just lift her, put her feet on his feet and walk her in holding his hands. I'm actually gesturing that like people can see me.
But people would know the thing.
You know, when the child stands on your feet and you do the walk, you just do that silently. Get her feet and just walk her back in. Make it more playful than verbal. I think when it's nighttime, because I'm also hearing here that dad is almost like the consolation prize at nighttime.
Yeah,
you know, you got to endure dad, so you get to enjoy mom every second night. And I wonder if there's a way of making that more team you and dad and making that more fun. You know, they could have a little game, a little song, you know, that's just their thing. On dad's nights, we always play I Spy, for example.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever it might be. Anything like that, I would think I would like to increase more playfulness, more flexibility into this routine, less rigidity.
Yeah.
Because I think where you're having the flashpoints of your child not liking it is five-year-olds are not renowned for their acceptance of rigidity. They see that as an invitation to see, well, let's see now. If I go loud and long, am I going to crash through? With a new baby there, I think there needs to be more flexibility around routine. Quite typical to see some regression in previously held routines as well.
Yeah.
So really just trying to get through this in a way that everybody gets a night's sleep is the goal.
Yeah. But if daddy is the consolation prize at this point, when the baby arrives, he'll be even more the consolation prize.
I would be increasing the playtime. So it's not just bedtime. I'd be getting outside before bed, having kick a ball around, play chasing, have a laugh, do a lot of play so that actually we're playfully connected at the point of transitioning to bedtime.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that would make a huge help here as opposed to whatever your child is doing and saying, oh, it's dad's night. It just feels very directive and rigid and not so child-centered with that. And I think, look, getting a sleep routine is no easy thing to do. So you might be listening going, no, Joanna, we fought long and hard for this routine. We're not giving it up. So I'm not saying give it up. Just try to embed more playfulness in it because that will naturally bring more flexibility.
Yeah. Also, if there's a bedtime book, you know, if you really, you know, put some work into performing that bedtime book, then that can make a
beautiful
difference.
Thing. You could also get a really big book that has lots of stories or lots of chapters. So on Dad's Night, we read a chapter from that book. So I'm really excited to get up and read chapter 2 and chapter 6 and whatever it might be as we work our way through it. Anything that promotes more playful connection is going to be easier for your child to accept the routine.
Yeah, and best of luck with the new baby
as well.
Joanna, thanks a million
as ever.
Joanna Fortune, there you are, listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. We're going to take a break. After that, the Olympic flame begins its long run.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.